Welcome to this podcast by The Rocks Church. We hope you find it challenging and inspiring. For more information, visit therocks.org.au.
There's a saying that people say in church oftentimes. It goes like this: God is good. Yeah, all the time. Yeah, and like if you're new, you're like, what's happening? What's happening? There's like a secret handshake? The answer is yes. No, there's no handshake. All right, so God is good all the time, all the time. God is good for this before. Now, here's the thing about that. Good's a fascinating word. When you were a kid and your mom told you to be good, was she telling you to do something or not do something? Not do something, right? Jason, stop throwing the hamster. Jason, don't hit your sister. Jason, be good, hypothetically speaking. Right? Jason, be good. Right? Does it make sense? Or think about this. Never in the history of the world has a child gone up to, this happens a lot actually, a child go up to a parent, raise your hand if you're a parent, and your kids have come up to you and said, Mom, Dad, I'm bored. All the time, right? Yeah, all the time. Mom, Dad, I'm bored. When we get, I'm bored, right? It's fantastic. That's how I sound when I yell at my parents. Even now, I'm 35. Right? Never in the history of time have parents turned to their children and said, well, be good. No, that doesn't work. I was being good. That's why I'm bored. Does that make sense? And what starts to happen is we start to have, because words matter, and good starts to get confused for an absence of evil rather than the opposite of evil. Because the reality is you can get rid of all the evil in your life. Let's pretend that was true. You can get rid of all the evil in your life. That would not make you good. That would make you boring. Let's just be real about that. And one of the reasons why people outside the church are not attracted to people inside the church is because people inside the church are only known for what they don't do rather than for what they're passionately, radically about. Do you hear? Does that make sense? What would it look like if we took Jesus at his word that he came to give us a life and a life, a better life than we ever dreamed of, better than shampoo? What if we took him at his word and we started engaging in life like that was possible for us rather than just what Dallas Willard calls sin management? Making sure that we just tick off all the boxes. Don't do drugs, don't have sex, don't watch radar movies, don't listen to rock and roll. You know what I'm talking about? Like, don't. And man, and by the way, if you're like in youth ministry, right, parents will used to bring kids to me. And the reason why is because they're being bad. Right? Fix them. You get them for an hour a week. Fix them. I'm like, well, you get them for like 100 hours a week. You fix them. Right? And the thing is people don't need fixing. They need freedom. People don't need fixing. They need freedom. People don't need a prison. They need permission. And the problem is we've been telling people no, 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 when Jesus has been saying yes, yes, yes. So how do we begin to unlock the permission that Jesus has given us in our lives? How do we begin to excavate the freedom that God has already paid for by his son on the cross? So what I want to do is I want to give you possibly five, depending on how much time we have, maybe four or three, depending on how long-winded I am, elements to unleashing this kind of life. Now, by way of introduction to this, are you ready? Ready to go? Yes. Are we doing okay? No, I've lost some of you already. It's all right. Okay. But by way of introduction, how many of you love to run? Yeah, great. No one likes you. I mean, someone probably likes you. You look great. But the rest of you, no one likes you. Right? What about the people who don't like to run? Yeah, raise them high. Raise them proud. This is. Come on now. You're my people. You are my people, right? Who hates running? Yes. My father coached basketball, soccer, football. He's an amazing athlete. And then he had me for a son. And I stink at all those things. So we had a great relationship, you know. But he taught me this phrase. He said this: you never see a happy runner. Think about it, people who run. Now, here's the thing. People who run, I know you're happy. I get it. No one likes you. All right. Think about it, though. You're driving to church on a Sunday morning, and you see somebody running. Do they look happy? Does anybody run like this? I mean, maybe Bolt does, right? When you watch the Olympics, he's like, yeah, what's up? Buy my shampoo, right? Or whatever. Maybe he does. But other than that, no one, when they're running, they look happy. They look like they're doing complex math problems in their head. Like, carry the one. You know, right? That kind of thing. Or anybody like to watch the Olympics? I loved it when the Olympics came to Sydney. That was fantastic, right? And someone wins the 1,000-meter dash, and it's like the best moment in their life, and the TVs and everyone in all different languages are watching, and do they look happy? No. Looks like someone ripped off one of their toenails, right? It's like, ah! You know, and you don't know whether to clap or call an ambulance. Like, it's very confusing. So growing up, I hated running. Then years ago, I got introduced to this guy named Dean Karnazes. Anybody heard of Dean Karnazes before? Dean Karnazes is an ultra marathon runner. I think a marathon is anything like, what, like 30, 40 kilometers, something like that? An ultra marathon is going to be like 200 kilometers, something like that, okay? Dean has done 50 consecutive marathons in 50 American states in 50 days, right? Then when he was done, whoo, he ran home from New York to San Francisco, okay? So this guy is like a living, breathing Forrest Gump, right? He likes running. Right? Loves running. He did a Badlands marathon through Death Valley, like 36 degrees Celsius, right? That it was so hot that he had to run on the dotted line of the highway, otherwise his shoes would melt. As he was running, there was a car driving next to him that would give him bread for sustenance, and when they rolled down the window to give him bread, the bread would toast. My favorite story about Dean is he ran 120 miles, so it'd be like a 200-plus kilometer relay race, against 8 other teams of 12 people each, and he ran it by himself. And he actually beat one of the teams. Now, can you imagine being the team? Huh. That lost. Right? Hey, Bill. Hey, Gary. Hey, Sam. Who beat us? That guy over there. And Dean's like, hey, I like running. Right? Now, here's the deal. When I was a kid, I hated running. And I remember hearing this story, and tell me if you've been here. No kidding, I heard this story, and I started looking around for the nearest pair of running shoes. You know what I'm talking about? When you see somebody do something extraordinary, doesn't it create this gravitational pull for you? When you see somebody push the limits, when you see someone step outside of the bounds of what everyone else is doing, when they step outside of the bounds of comfort, outside of the bounds of mediocrity, outside of the bounds of what everyone else says is normal, it creates this gravitational pull. It's disruptive. And all of a sudden, people who have no business running start looking around for the nearest pair of running shoes. And it's been my experience and my conviction in interacting with the person of Jesus that Jesus is like the Dean Karnazes of life. That he wasn't selling shampoo. He was actually selling a lifestyle that is expansive and explosive and beautiful and wonderful. And Jesus was disruptive to people who were normal and average. He was saying, there's a better way to live. There's a better way to live. There's a better way to live. So the first element we're going to talk about this morning. Oh, actually, let's be faithful to the slides. You guys are doing great back there. Shall we do that? Shall we do what the talk that was planned? How about that? That sound good? Okay, great. So have you ever wondered what God's will for your life is? Some of you are like, no. Great, welcome to our show. Okay, that's kind of, you know, what we do around here, right? Has anyone ever wondered what God's will for your life is? Right, and have you ever gotten like ridiculously specific about it? Right, that's usually how it works for me. Right, when I'm ever wondering like what God's will for my life is, it's like, what is, you know, should I date this person or this person? Should I marry this person or should I marry this person? Should I make this a financial investment or should I take this financial? You ever been there? Whoa, yeah, is that what usually happens? Oh, okay, great. Yeah. That's how. Let there be light. See, words create worlds. It's great, especially when you have a tech team working things out. All right, yeah. Anybody ever wonder what the will of God is for your life? Right, and have you ever wondered the will of God for your life, and then you go to the scriptures, and the scriptures aren't helpful? Let's just be real about that, right? You're like, hey, should I marry Susie or Jackie? And you open up to like 1 Jason chapter 7, and like God's like, marry Jackie, and you're like, okay, she was the prettier one anyway. All right, let's go, you know? Or you're like, you turn up, it's like, marry Lucy, and you're like, man, is there like another page? Does God ever go like, psych? You know, it's like chapter 7. You didn't read chapter 7. Psych, marry Jackie. Yeah! Right? You know what I'm talking about? Right? It's amazing how sometimes we go to the scriptures and the questions we're asking are not the answers they're trying to give us. And part of the purpose of the scriptures is not to give us answers, but to shape our questions. Right? And so what's interesting is like there is a passage of scripture that says, this is the will of God for you. Did you know that? There is a Bible verse that says, this is the will of God for your life. And here we go. This is the will of God for your life. And I remember the first time I saw that phrase, I was like, yeah. Who wants to know? Right? I want to know the will of God for my life. This is going to be great. This is going to be awesome. Julie or Jackie, right? turn left or turn right, take this job or this job. This is going to be fantastic. And you can imagine how disappointed I was when I read the rest of the sentence. For this is the will of God. Your word I'd never heard of before. Is that like a chiropractor? Your sanctification. Like, what is that? Is that like a workout program? Like, what, you know what I'm talking about? And I remember, have you ever had a moment when you've been just like drastically disappointed? Like after an American election? you ever had, hypothetically speaking, a moment when you're like, it's going to be great. And then afterwards you're like, oh, man. Yeah, that's kind of how I felt after reading this verse. I was like, oh, man. Sanctification, what does that even mean? And so I started looking into it. And then there's another word for sanctification. Anybody know what it is? Holy. And then it got worse. Right? Because to be holy in my life was to be boring. Right? Even like phrases, people, when we use the word holy, it's not in a good way. Like a casual, like if two people are talking and someone thinks they're self-righteous, right? If someone is arrogant, if someone thinks they're better than everybody else, what do we call them? No comment. You're fired. Fake news. I don't know. All right. Yeah. If someone thinks about you, ever heard the phrase holier than thou? Yeah. Ever heard that phrase? Holier than thou? Oh, he's just so holy. It's never like a good thing, right? Now, we use it in church like a good thing, but usually the way we use it outside is what the real meaning is to us versus the way we use it in here. You ever notice that before? You ever notice how words in here have different definitions than out there? Right? And so I was not inspired by that. But then I started meeting people who followed Jesus who were incredible, who were intoxicating, who were inspiring. And that's when I started to understand that the word sanctification doesn't mean to like stop doing a bunch of things. The word sanctification, the word holy, doesn't mean a list of things I don't get to do. Now let's put the next slide up. The word sanctification means to become extraordinary. To be holy is to be extraordinary. It is to step outside of what everyone else is doing. And to let me tell you, people who've been married for 50 years, that's extraordinary. It's easy having 7 wives. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. Not at the same time. That sounds like a lot of work, right? It's easy to get married, divorce, get married, divorce, get married, divorce, get married, divorce, get married, divorce. Like that's, I live in LA. That's like a game show there. I mean, it's no problem. Hey, how many wives did you have? How many times have you been married? 7? Oh, I've been 8. It's like casual conversation, right? That kind of thing. Like that's easy. But being married to one person for 70 years, that's hard. That's extraordinary. That's inspiring. That's holy. Right? Look, throwing a couple bucks in the offering, that's great. That's no problem. Or like spending all your money on yourself. Again, LA, right? I'm from Los Angeles. I live in Beverly Hills, right? So spending money on yourself, that's easy. That's easy. Living a life of radical financial generosity, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. You know, when we spend in LA, when we spend money on ourselves to make ourselves look pretty, when you spend money on others, you become beautiful. One thing is easy. The other thing is extraordinary. Right? So this is the will of God for your life, to become extraordinary. He designed you for it. He made you for it. When God crafted you in your mother's womb, the scripture said that he has plans for you that he did long ago, and those plans are breathtaking. In fact, one of the reasons I'm convinced why he doesn't tell us what his plans are is because if he told us what the plans are, it'd freak us out, right? Because our souls don't yet have an appetite for the beauty that is before us. And the more we connect to God, the more he changes our appetites and he lets us in bit by bit, step by step, moment by moment, is saying, oh, you're going to love this. Oh, you're going to love this. Oh, this part's going to be painful, but then you're going to love it. Trust me. Just trust me. You're going to love what I'm up to. And then the thing is he doesn't do it on his own. He invites us to be co-conspirators. He invites us to be co-conspirators in this journey. So with that being said, I'm going to give you a few practical things. Sound good? All right, so the first one, everyone say risk. That's the first element. When we're talking about what does it mean to live a sanctified life? What does it look like to live a holy life? What does it look like to live an extraordinary life? It is not possible. Hear me. It is not possible. It is not possible unless you live a life of risk. In fact, you cannot show me one historical person in the scriptures whose life wasn't defined by risk. Who are some people? And again, if you're new to our show, we're glad you're here. So the scriptures have lots of characters in them, like lots of heroes. Like usually they're anti-heroes because their lives are really messed up. And that's great about them is because they're like us, right? So what are the names of some people from the scriptures who God like held up as examples for our lives? Yeah, David. Was David's life typified by risk? Yes. If you don't know King David, he became king because he went up against a gig guy, took the stone, gets the guy, killed the giant, chopped his head off, which is a little graphic because he was a kid. And let's be real, the scriptures are violent, right? Okay? He lived a life of risk. Somebody else? Paul. Did Paul live a life of risk? Yeah, a guy was responsible for writing most of the New Testament, right? He was stoned, like the old-fashioned kind. They threw rocks, not the LA kind. They threw rocks at him, right? Right? He risked life and death over and over and over and over again to remind people that they were valuable and that God had a future for them. Somebody else? Moses. Did Moses risk? Yes. Went up against Pharaoh. And we can throw out a lady, right? Esther also went up against King Xerxes. Esther was a beauty queen, so she would have fit in Beverly Hills, right? The beauty queen, and then she went up to Donald Trump and she said, "Hey, look, you're doing it wrong." And he could, and Donald could have killed her, right? Because Esther took a risk. Esther, David, Moses, Paul, Jesus. You don't get to be in the scriptures unless your life is defined by risk, right? And what I want, usually, think about the moments when you grew the most. Think about the moments in your life when you grew the most. Was it or was it not defined by risk? Think about the moments when you step into the unknown, where you step beyond yourself. By definition, those are moments of risk. And so years ago, I was working for this amazing faith community called Mosaic in Los Angeles, and we were trying to figure out how do we invite people to practice a lifestyle of risk the same way we practice playing the piano. Because you can do that. That risk is a muscle that you can develop, just like going to the gym to build your abs, your biceps. You can go and you can actually practice taking risks. So we developed this space called Spark Groups. And we piloted them at Pepperdine University. You ever hear of Pepperdine University before? It's in Malibu, California. And so it's like this gorgeous campus as it looks over the ocean. I got to be a professor there for a while, and it was a lot of fun. And so we started these groups, and there was one woman who participated in the group. Her name was Lauren. Lauren, have you ever met a girl she's a leader, but she's really quiet? You ever met someone like that before? Right? Like you can sense her power, but she just hasn't learned that she's got it quite yet. You know what I'm talking about? And her risk was to go to her coach and say she wants to be an Olympic trainer someday. Now, to most of us, that doesn't sound like that big of a risk. Just go to your, you know, go to your coach and tell him what you want to do with your life. It's college. That's what we do, right? But first, a couple of things. First of all, you ever have a coach who wasn't like exactly the nicest guy or girl in the world? You know, like coaches aren't necessarily known for being like cuddly teddy bears, right? That's not what they get paid for. Get over here, kid. Oh, you're hurting? Go ahead, sit down. Can I do something for you? Right, that kind of thing. Coaches aren't like that, right? Right. And going and telling your coach that you want to be an Olympic trainer someday is kind of like saying, I want to be better than you someday. So that's awkward, right? So Lauren goes into the meeting, and she kind of hem-haws around. You ever do that? You ever have something important you want to say to somebody, but you're like talking about the weather first, right? And the coach, her coach is like, hey, Lauren, just spit it out. Like, why are you here? And she's nervous. And so like a confession, she says, I want to be an Olympic trainer someday. And now it's out there, right? It's like her little dream bubble. And because her coach is kind and supportive and encouraging, he says, that's impossible. And her little dream bubble goes, and then he makes it worse. He's like, hey, sweetheart, like in order to even come close to doing that, you'd have to do an internship in Colorado Springs. That's where the training headquarters is. That's super competitive. It's almost more competitive than being an athlete. And he just starts laying all these obstacles, right? Like you'd have to know somebody, have connections, all this kind of thing. It's super hard, super hard. And she just hangs her head. And before the first tear starts to fall, she hears the strangest noise. She hears him pick up the phone. She hears him dial a number. And then she hears him say, hey, Judy, yeah, how's Colorado? Good, yeah, hey, I've got this girl here, Lauren. She is fantastic. She really needs to be an intern for you at the Olympic headquarters. Hands Lauren the phone in the meeting, and that summer she went to Colorado Springs to become, and years later she became an Olympic trainer. Here's the question. What could be happening in your life if you just took a little more risk? What dreams are right on the other side of a choice that are waiting to be grabbed by you if you just took a little bit more risk? Not a lot, just a little bit more risk in your relationships, in your finances, in serving your friends, in serving the world, right, in serving the city. What risks are waiting inside of you to be done if you just step out and make the choice? That's the first element. Everyone say risk. All right, so now we're going to move on to the second element. Just hang tight in the back just for a second. Because how many of you know people who are risk takers and they are also idiots? Shh, over here from last time. Shh, how many of you know someone who's a risk taker, but they're also stupid, right? And they take what we would call stupid risks. And you watch them and they're so proud of themselves. I'm a risk taker. And you're like, you're going to be poor the rest of your life. If you live the rest of your life. Anybody ever heard of the American celebrity Johnny Knoxville? He had a show, the name of the show I can't say, in church. And that guy's probably infertile because he's been kicked in places so many times that his body parts don't work anymore. Right? His life is defined by stupid risk. So it's not just any kind of risk that we're talking about. It's risk of, second word, generosity. Everyone say generosity. Yes. Okay, great. So, this might be a little much for the young kids. So, if you've got somebody under the age of 10, you ready? Now you're like, "Oh, what's he going to say?" This is going to be great. Right, when I was a kid at Christmas, I loved Christmas, didn't you? You remember being a kid for Christmas? It was the best. Right? I couldn't sleep for weeks. My parents hated it. It was great, right? And then like the day of Christmas, you remember? Like for us, we had like stairs, and so my sister and I would be at the top of the stairs, and like everything would be set up and everything, and like it was like a horse race, right? And they're off. Here comes Manny and Jason running around the corner. They're ripping up. Ah, it's an Xbox. Like that kind of, you know what I'm talking about? It was the best. And here's what's fascinating. You remember, the older you got, the worse Christmas got. So if you're young, just get ready. It gets worse. Right, your teens, Christmas is cool, but not that cool. Because look, when you were a kid, like I remember my nephews were like 2 and 4. I could go like to Target and buy them a ball. I wouldn't even have to wrap it. And I'd walk in on Christmas Day, kick the door open like a vigilante, and be like, "Yes!" And they would look up at me, and they wouldn't be like, "Dude, a ball? Seriously, that's like a later model." Right, they wouldn't be like that. They'd be like, "A ball! Yes!" And I'd be like, "Yes! I am like Santa, because I bought you a ball." You remember that, parents? Those were the easy days. Now you're like 16, 17 years old, and everything they want costs hundreds of dollars. I'm 35. If my parents want to blow me away, they got to buy me a house or something. Right? I mean, it's just, right? And I got older, and Christmas got worse. And then all of a sudden, my sister... I remember very clearly, one Christmas, my sister, her Christmases, mine was getting worse and worse and worse. All of a sudden, her Christmas was starting getting better and better and better. And it confused me. And it angered me. So I started doing like a compare and contrast. What's the difference? So first thing, my sister's married. That can't be it. What else? Well, they've been married for a while. What do you think it was? Yeah, they had kids. And that's when I learned the dirty little secret of Christmas is you think, kids, you think that you are having the most fun on Christmas morning. You are not. There are two people who, even though they're not being particularly nice to each other, in that particular moment, who are actually having more fun than you. They're called your parents. And even though they're complaining about the instructions and what language things are in and how to make the toy work or whatever, they are having, you got a ball? They're having a ball. Because in the scriptures it says this, it is way more fun to give than it is to receive. So it's not just taking any kind of risk, it's taking risks of generosity. It's about stepping into generosity. They have done so many studies on this. It is ridiculous. The generous life is a psychologically healthy life. The generous life is a neurochemically beautiful life. The generous, doesn't matter what you believe, where you come from, you don't have to believe in God. If you're here today and the only thing you're like, God's nuts. I don't, imaginary friend, I don't buy any of it. Right? That's totally fine. But do a favor to yourself. Become generous. You don't have to give here. Give somewhere. Right? Just start stepping into acts of generosity. I was working with a friend of mine years ago. I met my friend Jennifer Kenning. She is amazing. She was working with a giant wealth fund management company in LA, making massive amounts of money, working with people with massive amounts of money, and she was bored out of her mind. And we started becoming friends, and she started getting introduced to the scriptures and introduced to this idea of risks of generosity, and it intrigued her. It intrigued her. She was like, ooh, I wonder, could I play? Could I be a part of something like that? Could I be a part of something that matters, not just helping add zeros to rich people's bank accounts, which is fine, but I want to do something a little more significant than that. So she did what most people do who are making lots of money. She quit her job. And she started with the former CFO of Apple. She started a for-profit / non-profit organization that is committed to serving the world's poorest billion people. And she's on a mission to raise, I think, $10 billion to do it. And she travels the world. I never see her. And whenever we talk, I ask her, how do you have the time for all this? How do you have the energy for this? And she says, Jason, you don't understand. This kind of stuff doesn't take energy from me. This kind of stuff gives me energy. I'm telling you, if you're tired, if you live in a chronic state of fatigue, you might have mono, so like that's one thing, right? But if you live a tired life, the pill I want to invite you to swallow is not rest, but generosity. For some of us, the reason why we keep trying to fill our hearts with more and more rest, more and more holiday, more and more breaks, or buy stuff to make our lives more and more comfortable, and you will not be satisfied until you start stepping into a life of generosity. Okay, real quick, two more things. So that's, what was the first one? Risk. Second one? Generosity. Third one is failure. Everyone say failure. We're going to skip that one. There we go. Failure. This is my favorite one. Have you ever taken a risk of generosity and it didn't work? Raise your hand if you've ever taken a risk of generosity and you fell flat on your face. Yes. My people. That's fantastic. Right? So we were working with Pepperdine University kids. There's a kid named Jordan. Have you ever met a kid who's arrogant? That was Jordan. He was so cocky. He was awesome. I love cocky kids. They're so much fun to mess with. Oh, man. He was great. He was the cockiest kid I ever met. In fact, their first day of class, everyone went around and said something stupid they did when they were 10 years old. Everybody has something stupid they did when they were 10 years old. Everybody. And we got around to him, and he couldn't think of anything. And I said, you can't think of anything stupid. You did. In that season of your life. And he looked at me with a straight face and he goes, well, Jason, if I did it, why would it be stupid? So we love Jordan. Jordan's risk was to compose a love song and perform it on a guitar, which he didn't know how to play, to a girl who didn't know if he existed or not. So we were excited about this. Jordan goes and does his thing, comes back the next week, and he's smiling. And we like, oh, wow, how did it go? He said, it went great. And we said, did she fall in love with you? He said, no. She filed a restraining order. Because here's the deal. He felt great. He felt fine. Because, look, there are some risks that aren't worth taking, even if they're successful. Can we agree? There are other risks that are only worth taking if they're successful. But then there are some risks. There are some risks that they're worth taking, whether you are successful or not. Right? And what Jesus wants to call, Jesus never promises us success. What he promises is a journey that will refine us in our character. Right? He's not promising you the risk is going to work out. What he's promising you is that you'll become the kind of person who can survive any risk. Right? That you will be, not that you will get what you want, but that what you want will be to become strong. He's reforming something in us. And when we take risks, we fail. But here's the deal. Here's what's funny. The problem with risk is when we fail, what tends to happen? Everybody take a risk and they failed. What tends to happen when we fail? We stop trying. Anybody ever been that way? Right? And some of you, it's interesting sometimes as an executive coach to invite people to notice where they've stopped trying. Right? Maybe it's with that son or daughter. Maybe it's with the spouse. Maybe it's with the in-laws or your parents. Maybe it's with a dream you wanted to pursue or a career. And look, sometimes it's okay to stop trying. Can we just be real about that? Sometimes the extraordinary, dangerous thing to do is to stop. No problem. But sometimes we let things go way too early. Way too early. Because failure becomes fatal versus becoming a stepping stone and stepping into something else. So what was the first thing? Risk. Second thing? Generosity. Third thing? Failure. And here's the deal. If you take risks to generosity, I promise you'll fail. But if you get back up, it's called progress. Everyone say progress. This is one of my favorite stories to tell. And it has nothing to do with me, which is rare because I'm a narcissist. All right, so because I'm an American. Proud to be an American because at least I know I'm right. You know, that kind of thing. All right, so, all right. I grew up in the golden era of Disney animation. When I was a kid, I loved Disney. I remember very clearly in 1988 walking out of The Little Mermaid. Any fans of The Little Mermaid? Right? Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Yeah. Come on now. Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Ladies, wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything. My dad's an athlete. Yeah, lots of great movies came out by Disney in that era. Do you remember? Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, come on. Robin Williams, amazing, right? The Lion King, Elton John, what are you doing to me, right? It's fantastic, right? That was the golden era of Disney animation, and I fell in love with storytelling. I did. I fell in love with great stories, and I was spoiled because they were just telling one great story after the other. So then imagine years later when I moved to Los Angeles, and I get to do work with people who work at Disney. I get to drive on the lot, and I got a little name tag and everything, and I'm feeling really good. And I was driving through West Hollywood, and I see a big billboard for a new Disney animated feature. This is a few years ago, and I got excited. Like the little 10-year-old inside of you, right? You know what I'm talking about? He's like jumping up and down. He's like, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. And I get excited and I look and I start, my mind starts to race. What story had the Disney gods decided to tell us mere mortals? What soundtrack? What like quirky sidekick? You know, what's going on? And I got big and I got closer and in big letters, you can imagine how I felt when I saw the words Bambi 2. And that little 10-year-old inside of me died that day. And in that season of Disney's history, that's when I realized they were no longer the kings of story. Right? But there was actually another dog in town. And what was their name? Pixar. That's right. Pixar is the most successful film company in the history of cinematography. Every time Pixar wants to tell a story, they're going to make about $500 million. Not bad. Right? And what are some Pixar movies? Yeah, Toy Story, Finding Nemo, Wall-E, Ratatouille, The Incredibles, right? Come on. These are great, great stories. And a few years into Disney's, or a few years into Pixar's history, they're getting ready to tell their first sequel. Now, what's usually true about sequels? Yeah, we're in church. They stink. They suck. All right. What are some examples of sucky sequels? Bambi 2. Yeah, great. Yeah. Right? Anybody ever see the movie Speed 2? On a boat. It's called Speed. On a boat. Willem Dafoe with leeches. It's weird. It's a weird movie, right? Yeah, usually they suck. In the words of Ed Catmull, who's the president of Pixar Animation, he said, every film has its sucky phase. This was too sucky too late. Because they were telling their first sequel. And they didn't know what to do. And what they were going to do is they were going to just release it straight to video. You know what I'm talking about? Like straight to DVD. Right? But what they knew was that if we start telling stories and releasing them straight to DVD, it's going to create two different cultures in our company, right? A feature film culture and a straight-to-video culture. And the straight-to-video culture will infect the feature film culture. It's never the other way around, right? And so they didn't know what to do. And so John Lasseter, Ed Catmull, Pete Docter, Andrew Stanton, all the founders of Pixar, the brain trust they call it, they had a meeting. Like, what are we going to do? And then they called all the animators together in a big room like this one. Actually, I've been to Pixar. It looks a lot like this, right? And they said, here's the deal. We don't tell bad stories. We're going to burn the candle at both ends. We're going to redo the storyboards. We're going to gut the thing, and we're going to do what needs to be done. And 9 months later, what was released is Toy Story 2, which is one of the most successful sequels of all time and generated over $120 million more than the original. And I remember hearing that story, and I remember thinking, all of us have that exact same choice. All of us have the choice of whether we want to live lives that are feature film or straight to DVD. All of us. I'm not talking about wealth and fame and hello, my darling. I'm just talking about the texture of your life. And imagine, and if this in this moment, you said, I want to live a life that is feature film. I want to live a life of risk. I want to live a life of generosity. Like all great lives, I want to have some juicy failures in my life that are worth failing for. And then I want to get back up. I want to get back up. I want to get back up. And when I do, we call that progress. Because God has a life that is better than you ever dreamed of. But I'm telling you, it ain't going to happen unless you follow him to places that only people of risk can go. That he wants to invite you into a journey. I'm going to give you a heads up. It's going to hurt. But so does mediocrity. So if you're going to suffer for something, you might as well suffer for something extraordinary. Does that make sense? Right? If you take risks of generosity, you will fail, but you get back up and you'll experience progress. That is what this community exists for, to say God has a life for you. He has a life for you, a better life than you ever dreamed of. And I want to thank you for spending time with me this morning. Thank you, Daniel, so much for having me. Can I pray for us real quick? God, thank you so much for inviting us into life. Thank you so much for your son when he echoed those words thousands of years ago, that you came to give us a better life than we ever dreamed of. Thank you for saying that your will for our lives is our sanctification, that we would become extraordinary human beings. We love you. We love you. May we take risks even now of generosity. May we be okay with failure. And may we get back up so we can experience the progress you want to have in our lives. We love you. It's in the name of Jesus we all pray. Shazam. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For more great resources and to keep yourself up to date, head to our website, therocks.org.au.